And welcome back to the Foxhole for another wonderful time episode interview, whatever you want to call it. I'm your host, Matt, and I have Brock with me here today. And
yes, indeed. 2021, baby.
I mean, I say today as if it's like not, you know, every single time that we do this interview that yeah. we knew. But, okay. You know, new year, new podcast, not really, but we're gonna treat it like such, you know.
Amen.
Yeah. How's your, you know, it's only been a couple days, but how's your new year going?
It's good, man. I'm trying to keep staying at work, and we're all like really waiting for the, you know, the vaccines to come through. I think everybody's really anticipating, you know, having that sort of that sense of security behind them. But I'm just excited to get this year rolling. And with the podcast, man, it's crazy. It just keeps growing and growing. And today's interview is no exception. It's pretty, I mean, I'm pretty excited to bring him. Oh, his name is Andy. I think if I'm not mistaken, he reached out to us because he got word of the podcast or saw the podcast promoting on Instagram or something, and reached out to Domenico.
So my parents used to take me on trips all the time when I was little, and because they're a lot older, they're in their, like, you know, my dad's in his late 70s now. My mom is in her she's almost 70 now too, then. She's getting up there. But so they always had kind of like a, like, you know, that end game where they're like, oh, we're gonna go and we're gonna travel the world and visit things, and then I came along plop, and so they're like, well, I guess we have to take this this toddler, young when I was a tween, they took me along. So I got to travel a bunch, and it's been probably like 8 or so years since we've done a family vacation. And they were planning on going to Japan. And I was like, I'm so jealous of you guys going to Japan. They're like, yeah, well, we're doing a tour. It's with a bunch of old, like, you know, it's going to be a bunch of older people. Is this really what you want to do? And I was like, hell yeah. What? Fucking take me to Japan.
Of course. Where are you going? What's the plan? Like, whereabouts are you going?
So it's like a trip where we're going to be kind of going, I think we fly into like near Tokyo, and then we kind of travel all the way down to the South Island and then all the way back up. So it's kind of like just a trip all over Japan. Which is something I've been wanting to do for God knows how long. I am so excited. And there's some days that they're like, we don't have anything planned for the trip, so we're just gonna, you get to kind of like go off and do whatever you want. And I'm like, oh,
that's dangerous.
Yeah, I get to just like go anywhere in the city. That sounds like, you know, the time of my life. So
yeah,
that's cool. And I'm incredibly excited to be able to really just go everywhere in the city, because it's going to be like, I get to go to so many different places and visit so many different things. And that just sounds like the time of my life. And
ride the train system, the bullet train system. I hope you get to ride the bullet train, man.
Oh, we take the train from place to place.
Yeah,
we take the train like all over. So yes, we do. I do get to take the bullet train, which I'm very, very, very excited for.
Yeah, that's the time of your life, man. That is something that, like, if our country could just like pinch off a smidge of their public transit system. I mean, it's so efficient that it's down to like, you know, the minute, you know, not even down to the minute. It's like down to the sec, you know, within 20 seconds or so, the train arrives, and it's like clockwork. But just remember that Cinderella train at midnight. You know, if you're not back, I had some horror stories, man. of dudes that Cinderella just got lost. Yeah, so midnight, all the trains close. And so my first train riding experience, right, we're on the train coming back from Roppongi outside Tokyo, going back to Itsugi. And Itsugi was about, I don't know, 40 minutes train ride. You got to hop on a couple. You got to have a couple changes. But at the very end of the night, there's the train conductors and the train sort of, the workers come with these bars, these like cattle bars. And they literally push everybody in, because after that, if they don't fit you on there, there's no more trains coming. So you either have to find a taxi or you better figure your way out. But yeah, I had this little Japanese guy fall asleep on my shoulder. And it's funny because in Japan, everybody has their bubble, right? Everybody's in their own zone. So privacy and sort of your own space is not really determined. Yeah. It doesn't really exist, but it does at the same time. So this little dude fell asleep on my shoulder, little 60-year-old man. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, dude, this is a trip, man. I can't believe I'm doing this right now.
60. Oh, man, that's so cute.
Yeah, he just sat there, and I'm holding on, smushed in there with all these freaking drunk-ass sailors. But, yeah, man, you're going to have the time of your life. It is, it is something to behold.
I am incredibly excited, and, you know, I need to get my passport redone, but that's at least I have quite a few months to get that taken care of.
Yeah.
Right. But enough about Japan. I could talk about this all
right. Day. We can talk about travel.
I'm excited to bring Andy in today, but I would like to we talked about this briefly in our little shoot the shit episode where we talked about what we did in 2020 and what we're planning on doing in 2021. If you haven't listened to it, go ahead and listen to it. But something that we were hoping to talk about or kind of get out there is we are always looking for new people to be on the show. Namely, we would really appreciate if anyone out there who is a a part of a minority community or is a female veteran. We have a lot of, you know, white guys that come on this show and we interview.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Here. There's nothing wrong with that. We just want to diversify our profile a little bit. You know, we just want to represent everybody here.
So if you know anyone or if you yourself want to be interviewed, we would very much appreciate it, and we would very much love to have you on. So don't be afraid to be like, I don't fit this demographics of what you typically do. We would still love to have you.
Right.
So I would encourage them to
go back and listen to Renee's podcast, because she really did an awesome job at just, you know, being herself and telling her story like her way. And, you know, she did it. I mean, she did it seamlessly, and, you know, it's just natural. It's just a conversation. So don't let the fact that there's only one, don't let the fact that you could be the second female deter you from reaching out. We want to hear your story, and we'd love to talk to you. So yeah, please reach out to us at our Instagram page at the Foxhole Podcast, or you can reach out to any of us who represent the Foxhole Theater Company or the Foxhole Podcast. So we're pretty stoked about this year. Let's get Andy in here. This is Warrior Surf Foundation is baby, and it's going to be cool to just get to just to kind of delve into his story and dive into the foxhole with him. What do you say?
Yeah. Well, without further ado, let's bring him in.
Welcome back to the Foxhole Podcast. We have Andy Manzi here with us today from quite quite a distance away, but we promise you, technology is doing its damnedest to get you a story here. Andy, it was an 0352. Correct me if I'm wrong. 0352, and it's pretty amazing. I did a little bit of look into like what that that MOS entailed. But kind of explain real quick for the listeners, Andy, like what that was like, just like a little like a headline for us.
So like the 0352 is just you get trained to fire this like 80-pound wire guided missile from different types of platforms, depending on the vehicle it's fired from or from the ground. But it can hit targets for at a pretty long range. But I had my secondary MOS was 0311. It's when I had like my most experience in. But yeah, so just a missileman, essentially.
Wow, we've had a lot of 0311 Marine. That is, I think, our most common denominator among the across the board is 0311 grunts. So wow, I'm starting to learn what that means. Wow.
You're picking it up.
I've come so far.
To be an anti-tank missileman, like you guys dealt with the Javelin weapon system and stuff like that. And we'll get into this once we get into the military sort of portion. But before we do that, you got to explain this foundation that, correct me if I'm wrong, you were the founder, right? You founded the foundation after you kind of fell in love with surfing, right?
Yeah, I started surfing in 2008. And in 2015, I officially co-founded it with two others in Folly Beach, South Carolina. But yeah, I came through my own journey through surfing after the war.
That's awesome. And you're currently in Guatemala. So where are you currently right now? Like what town are you in?
There's this little village called Peridon. It's on the Pacific coast south, a couple hours north of El Salvador. And it's just a village I've been coming down to, relax, recoup, and then do some work as well. But it's kind of like my second home. It's a really beautiful
place. That's awesome. Yeah, what brought you to Guatemala? Like why Guatemala? Like where you said it's like your second home?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time here. I mean, that's the way I view it. I live in Folly Beach, South Carolina, but I spend months down here and eventually gonna move down here in the next year. So
really?
Guatemala, my friend had told me and the lady I was dating at the time just about Guatemala, and he had surfed here and stuff, so we booked a trip here about 6 years ago and kind of fell in love with it. And a few months later, came back and started the process of buying land and establishing myself down here. And yeah, it's been a crazy journey since. But yeah, it's been a very, very unique place I'm very grateful to have in my life. So it's a really nice village. So.
How well do you speak the language right now? Are you pretty fluent?
No, man, my comprehension's gotten it's gotten better. I got to say, I probably comprehend 50% of what I hear in my speaking. Finally getting a lot, it's getting better.
That's awesome.
But yeah, I mean, the more time I spend here, the better it gets. So.
That's right. Yeah. And do you have, so part of your, and we'll get into this sort of like when we talk about it at the end and why this is, your passion and why this means so much to you. But do you currently have other veterans down there for the sort of travel camp that you do? Do you like bring veterans down to Guatemala?
Yeah, we normally do. It's kind of a part of our program. So we have our program back in the States, but 5 years ago, I started bringing small groups of veterans down for like week trips. And it's grown into like an official, structured retreat that we do every year, sometimes a couple weeks a year. But because of COVID this year, we had to push them back. But I have like today, for example, I have five veterans flying in just to come relax and do some surfing, some yoga.
That's awesome.
Hang out. But yeah, it's part of it's part of Warrior Surf Foundation. We've brought a bunch of vets down here, so, and family members, and they've done some really cool work and had some really intimate moments with some of the people that are from here. So it's pretty cool.
How are they dealing with COVID? Cool. Just like out of curiosity, how are they coping with that? Is it really like rampant, or is it pretty like isolated as far as it goes?
You know, man, it's different. This, you know, this way this country's set up, it's a small country, but it's like very regional, you know, and I think in some areas it was a problem. I mean, it's definitely an issue with foreigners coming in, I assume.
Right.
But on the beach itself, man, like, I don't know. It's pretty, no one even really talks about it.
Right.
So, but there's other places, you know, the rest of Latin America and other parts of Latin America have been ravaged by it just because of just like economic disparity, you know, and like, you know, massive groups of people that don't have access to the basic items of
healthcare.
And they're not the people traveling abroad and coming back and bringing it to these countries. But what it's causing Guatemala and what I've seen in Guatemala is, you know, when I left here at the end of February earlier this year, I was here for a couple months and everything was booming, man. Like this country was definitely had a lot of growth in it, and especially with the travel industry. And that's been completely wiped out in, you know, 8-10 months. Just kind of sad.
Have you been going back and forth like this entire quarantine? Like, have you been traveling the entire time?
We left, and then, you know, they shut the country, shut its borders until I think it was the end of September. So I missed it by like 10 days. So no, I was in South Carolina, man, working on the project and doing what we could there.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but we're blessed, man. I'm talking to you from Guatemala right now. So
yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't super bad in my life. So I'm grateful for that.
Absolutely.
So you're actually born in Connecticut, right in, I didn't even know there's a place called New London. So what was it like growing up in Connecticut? Cause obviously that's a, you know, a little bit different from South Carolina, a very lot different from Guatemala. What was it like growing up there originally?
Man, I'm lucky to have been raised there. You know, it is a really beautiful place. It's a small state. I was lucky enough to grow up along the coastline, you know, the eastern, like, Long Island Sound. So, like, spent a lot of time, like, going to the beach, in the water, out on boats a lot. You know, beautiful summers, long winters. But I grew up in an area where, you know, we had fairly good education, good network of people around me, you know, playing sports and whatnot, and a big family, you know. So I'm pretty blessed for, you know, growing up where I grew up. But yeah, it was, you know, really small. It was a diverse little area, you know. It's New London's a tough little town. I ended up graduating from a town over in Waterford. But man, it's home. I haven't lived there in years, and I have tons of love and support in that area still, and I'm totally grateful for it. You know, especially the education I was able to receive was pretty good for a public school, you know. But yeah, just, you know, I grew up around a kind of an interesting family. You know, but the town, the communities are really close, so I'm grateful but at the same time, you know, go to war, come home. It's not a place I really wanted to be anymore. So.
Small town or like?
It's pretty small. Yeah, how big was the town? My high school class, my graduating class was only like 190 kids. So it was like school in Connecticut. But yeah, man, I was super into sports and I loved to cook. So I cooked in high school. I loved football.
What position did you play? What position?
Played a bunch of positions, but you know, like I think my final days is like defensive end and I played left guard.
Nice.
So,
nice, dude.
Yeah. Definitely love
contact. You got the edge, man. That yeah. Edge. You're like no stranger to that. So that's amazing. That's so cool. Because you and I graduated the same year. And I just remember, I remember when we first kind of spoke, we graduated the same year. My high school class was fairly small too. And, you know, we've talked about this because it literally defines a whole generation of veterans and warriors, but 9/11 was a very pivotal moment, in my life, in your life, you know, what it did to me, you know, just countless people, countless men and women to like, want to step up and serve. We were both a little bit younger, so it's 2001, so we were like what, sophomores probably.
Yeah
Do you remember where you were when you saw that, like what did it do when you saw that, because you're on the East Coast too, so it's pretty close to home for you. I was in Colorado, but what did that, where were you remember that,
man? I actually 8:30 that morning, I had it I've told the story a bunch in other interviews, but it's kind of weird. At 8:30 that morning, I had my driver license exam, like the actual the street test, road course.
Wow.
And like I'm driving around with this dude, and my last name's Manzi, and it's like, it's an Italian last name. And he swore.
Yeah, I thought so. There we go.
he swore he knew, like, because my family's from New York. My dad's side is from New York. And we were just talking about New York, and he was just telling me what to do. And then like 10 minutes into it, I don't know, 15 minutes into it, like the news just came flooding over the radio about a plane hitting a building in New York. And then like, I don't know, a few minutes later, another one. And the guy lost his mind, started yelling in the car, and basically said, wow. I passed, bring him back. And
holy shit.
I never like had a parallel park. I never had to back up.
Oh my God.
I didn't do shit, honestly. Like I turned like a couple times. But you
That's
know, I
crazy.
Like, so you know, I'm in this moment, this time and space and time, and I'm super pumped. You know, I got the wheel, I'm gonna be able to drive on my own, and I just got this truck, you know, and like all this cool stuff. Because I lived a ways away from where I went to high school. So I needed to have my own car. So I'm super pumped. I go to the DMV, I get my license, and then I go to school. Stoked. I just got my driver's license. And man, it's like planes hitting buildings like 90 miles from where we're from. You know, and it was just like, I don't know.
You see it, look.
I can just remember just walking in my cafeteria, man, and like there are all these, you know, because high school kids, they don't care about anything.
For sure.
Yeah. Right over your head, yeah.
Whatever, kid. No matter what, like walk of life. You know, was watching that TV, and you know that affected a lot of communities in the Northeast, because you know, like Western Connecticut itself is a bunch of people that live in New York and are established in Manhattan. It's a big financial hub, you know. So like, there's a lot of bunch of people that weren't on the train coming home that day, and it just. Yeah. You know, it had nothing to do with, like, 9/11 didn't have much to do with the war I was involved in, but it was a catalyst.
Yeah.
Sure, like 3,000 right. Americans died. You know, and including people in those buildings from all over the world. It was the biggest financial hub in the world. There's people from all over the world that died in those buildings. You know, and
yeah, I think it was like 91 countries were represented with the people that lost their lives. I mean, it's just, it's insane, man. And it's, our country's never really seen, and hopefully never sees anything quite on that magnitude again. And you know, we look back at like Pearl Harbor and stuff, and it seems so distant. But like, and I've never been to Ground Zero, but I've been to Pearl Harbor Memorial and been over the USS Arizona. And like, you know, if you don't believe in like, you know, duty or you know the afterlife or whatever, you sort of feel some chills, because it's just an immense loss of life, and it really is just a defining moment for so many people. So it's crazy. What a crazy story, man. Get your driver's license and then to just be smacked with that reality. Did you know, as a sophomore, did you know that you were going to join pretty quickly?
No, I still I wanted to go to college so freaking bad, man. Like, I, nothing against my family. I love my family and whatnot, but there were a lot of people that went to college, you know, from the generation before me. I think one or two of them maybe went to college. And I just wanted to go to college. I just wanted to, like, and I wanted to be, I love culinary arts and I love cooking. So for a long time, I was going to go to Johnson & Wales in Providence, Rhode Island. And my senior year, you know, I told you guys the other day about that kid, Wayne Parrott. You know, he showed up to my locker room when I was a senior and I was suiting up for a football game. And he was just talking to me about boot camp. And, like, I looked at him and he was a good, he still is a good dude. And it's like, you should think into it, man. You'd be a good Marine. And just 9/11 was playing in the back of my head. And, you know, like, so I had no plan of being, going in the military. I wanted to go in the Coast Guard, but I was a little shit when I was a freshman. I got a lot of trouble. So, like, that's probably going to, like, get me DQ'd from that job. So, yeah, so I actually signed up to be reserves. I wanted to go to college as well. And then, but I was going to be like a motor T guy, like motor transport. And I was like, I can't go be Marine and like be motor transport. I'm like, I was talking to my dad and I was like, man, I don't want to go do all this training and just come home. Like, there's freaking Americans fighting overseas right now and I need to join them. And so I switched from reserve to active duty with an open 03 contract, 0311, 03 infantry contract. So no, I didn't really have much plans, but once I set it in my mind, I was doing it.
That was it. Yeah.
You know, because Connecticut, man, like we have some smaller cities, you know, but we don't have like a big city. We don't have like professional sports. Really, I mean, we got like WNBA and like lacrosse, I think now. I mean, they took our only hockey team away like 20 years ago. 30 years ago now, probably. You know, they still wear Hartford.
The Whalers?
Yeah, the Whalers.
Hartford.
Man.
Yeah, dude. I used to have a Hartford hat just because I freaking dug it so much. It was just, that's the shit, man.
So, you know, like, that's what we're wearing like sports gear that teams that doesn't even exist anymore. So like you have to attach yourself to a city almost. Like a lot of people are into the Boston or New York thing. You know, whether it's the Mets, the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Bruins, the Rangers. You know, my dad's side being from New York, like New York City was like I don't know. It was a place that you felt bad at. It was pretty cool to go to sometimes. And it was our city. I grew up watching the Yankees and going to the Bronx to see the baseball games. And like, for that to happen in New York, you know? So.
So you went into the Marines straight out of high school. Or immediately after graduating in 2003. Why specifically the Marines? Because I know that you, at one point, you were actually considering the reserves, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so that was the initial plan. Like I said, I wanted to go to college really bad, and I didn't want to wait. You know, I just wanted to go to college. And but then, like, when I started thinking about it, I was like, I can go to college after, you know? Mm-hmm. So I decided, I talked to one recruiter and I wanted to join the infantry, you know, after I signed up. So it was like, I started in reserves and then I decided college wasn't going to be the way right away. And I switched to active duty infantry because I couldn't go to that school and be attached to this other reserve unit. So I was like, no, man, I want to go fight.
Hmm. So it was a lot of the motivation was like, you know, like 9/11, like obviously, you know, fighting for your country. Do you ever look back at it and wonder if it was a hasty decision?
No.
Like, okay, so you put a lot of, because obviously, you know, it's a heavily emotional time, right? We have an attack on the country. And I'm not asking necessarily if you regret it. It's not like that. It's more of like, Do you ever think that you could have done it maybe a different way? Did you ever think like maybe I should have done officer school? Did you ever think like, you know, maybe it would have been more in line to have actually ended up joining the Navy or something like that? Like, I mean, so it's you do you ever look back at that and say like, I could have done it maybe a little differently?
Yeah, man. But if you do that, you know, like, you can open that book. You can open up that to so many different aspects of your life. So I, you know, like you can't, we don't have that option in this world to, you know, just the way it's the way it happens. The way it was, you know, sometimes we joke like, oh man, I should have joined the Coast Guard, but I couldn't. I was a shithead in my freshman year. So like, you know, it happened the way it was supposed to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it formed so much of, you know, hindsight being 2020, it formed so much of, you know, who you are and what you're doing for fellow veterans today, right? And sort of the legwork you're doing to speak to that community, which if you had gone another way, you might not have that opportunity, right? And as an East Coast Marine though, and it's funny because I had one of my best buddies is a 0311 as well. And he's from out here. He's from California and he got sent to Camp Lejeune as well. It's really, really strange because I know like West Coast, East Coast Marines, there's that whole, you know, divide. But what was it like? Do you remember? Because it's obviously pretty quick. You know, you graduate in 03, boom, you're out. They pump you there because, you know, you're either going to Iraq or Afghanistan. We'd already been in Afghanistan for a couple years. What was it like getting to Paris Island? Do you remember like what you felt when you stepped off the bus onto those yellow footprints?
Oh man. I mean, I shit my pants at the airport when we landed in Charleston. Like, oh man. Like
what did I get myself into?
The yellow footprints, you're like stoked for a minute. You're like,
yeah. I made it. Here we go. Right.
But you know, I always had this, like, once I made the decision, I think that's how I operate as a human being is I feel pulled to do these things and I do them. So like, as much as it sucked and Paris Island sucked, like I was going to be a Marine. I wasn't going home, not a Marine. You know, it wasn't that hard.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It'd have to get a hell of a lot harder for me not to make it. But like,
were you there during the summer, like during the heat?
Yeah. So I never I didn't travel a ton growing up. I went on vacations, you know, but I didn't spend any time south of Delaware ever. Not once. And so I showed up on July 1st, man, and it was like Africa. I mean, I lost so much weight.
For sure.
It was like, it was there July, August, and September.
Oh, man.
But.
Swelter.
So, yeah, it was overwhelming, man. But once you do it, if I ever do the what if scenario, it's like, what if I did all the training? And I didn't do a lot of training, man. Like, I just did the bare bones and I got sent overseas. But. What if I did all that and never went to a place like Iraq?
Yeah.
I mean, because it kind of like overshadows like everything that happened February 2004, you know?
Mm-hmm. Any, like in boot camp itself, any DI or instructor like stand out to you or anybody in your class or division that like was a straight character?
They were the three of them. We got a fourth one towards the end. She had a tough time because he got us like 2 weeks before we graduated, and we're like, anyways. But there was this one guy. He was like this Marine tanker of the year. He was this swear he's a Jamaican dude from New York, drill instructor. His name was like Staff Sergeant Ford or something. He was a badass. He was a small, he wasn't the biggest dude either, but I mean, yeah, he, me and him had a, had a relationship, I would say. My bearing was like, I don't talk about boot camp a lot, you know? It's like, if now they ask the questions to talk about it, it's hilarious. You know, it's so funny. The shit that goes goes down in boot camp. But that guy,
right,
I had like the worst bearing. And yeah, like talk at night, being a turd. And he, yeah. But man, like when I graduated, I remember him because he actually didn't give me my, you know, my EGA, what we get when we graduate. Feels like preschool in a 4-year war camp, a war, like 4-year military service. Like, I feel like when I graduated boot camp, comparably, it was just like getting out of preschool. And like, he gave me my, he couldn't give me my EGA, but when I graduated, he said, you know, I wish I could have given you the EGA. You earned it. Because he was really hard on me. So yeah, I mean, I hope that dude has 10 kids, is living his best life wherever he is. But that dude didn't do much then.
Probably does, man, after a life like that.
If anyone ever hears this, when people hear this podcast and they hear that name, someone will tell them about it. It's a small world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I remember him.
Have any weird kind of like crazy, I don't know, just stories or events that you saw, like you witnessed or were a part of, that kind of just will stick with you post boot camp?
Yeah, man. It was one time we were like, God, this is, I can't even tell this story, but they got to bring like,
you can use, like, you can use pseudo names too, call signs.
Yeah.
Whatever we did wasn't that important anyway. So like, they try to like get a bunch of Marines in this little corridor into the chow hall, all fed and seated and like an out. So like, there's a little competition between, I think, the drone instructors or something, but like our drone instructors, Sergeant Ford or Staff Sergeant Ford, whatever he was at the time, wasn't playing, and we were getting the chow hall before like he was, this other group, this other platoon. And I swear to God, like 60 recruits or whatever was left in that class, like we were ready to destroy like that other Marine, the other drone instructor. Like we were ready to like rip this guy apart in like seconds. And it was just like so ironic. Like this guy has given us so much shit over the past 13 weeks. You know, the other time is when they found out, you know the lozenges, the Ricola? Ricola lozenges. Right. One day, you know, they had that commercial like Ricola. It's like really old. It's like, I don't even know if they still have them. But it's basically like they found like a wrapper on this kid's pocket one day. And they made him do this exercise, like sun gods or something, for like 6 hours. And he had to say that word Ricola, like over and over again for the whole platoon while we just sit, watch, and like did whatever we had to do. Those are like some funny moments, you know? The time they found like corn pops on a recruit, like we all got messed up, man. Corn pops.
Yeah, it is. In his blouse, like he like tucked him in his pants or something, or where? It's like
in his pocket or something, or like
he's like crunching around, freaking this guy. Oh, no, no. Down.
Yeah. So, yeah, man. Yeah, boot camp. That was ages ago. Kid.
It's funny though, because that shit always sticks with you as far as the absurdity of it all. And like you said, it's funny that you kind of equated it to like preschool, because then you get to your MOS and your SOI training and all that, and it like steps up a notch, you know, and you realize you're still a boot. And where did you go to SOI, and like how was the transition to, obviously you're a rifleman first, 0311, but then that training to be an 0352, that's quite specialized. Pretty damn specialized. So kind of explain what that training was like. And
I appreciate you guys like trying to beef up the 0352 MOS, but like with a essentially a rocket. All right. And I had to put, we had to put the crosshairs on what you wanted to hit, and we hit a button, you know. But no, to bring back to SOI, like, it was different because, you know, we still got, like, you still get haze, not haze, but fuck, we got haze. There's a lot of, they have to train a lot, do a lot of things really fast. So it was just like, it was more aggravating than hard because you do a bunch of training together as a group and then you split out as in the MOSs. And so yeah, it is like we spent a long time as just an 0352 section in school, but we had to learn a lot of stuff like that was for like armor ID and like learning about Russian tanks, and because these were initially, you know, anti-tank weapons. And when I got into the Marine Corps, like, so it was a lot of like stuff I never thought. It was like, it was training. It was just like a lot of classroom stuff, honestly. And taking apart and putting together that weapon systems, it's a huge weapon system. And I think with like it all put together with a missile in it, it's like, it's over 100 and something pounds. And like, so like we were learning how to like set it up and take it down inside of a Humvee, because that's traditionally how they're still used, is on a Humvee, well, back then anyway. So,
like from the turret position or where?
So like on a LAV, which I was on light armored vehicles, it has its own other like vehicle that has this turret variant. Whereas most platoons that used them, or most Marines that used a tow at the time, generally fired from a Humvee and a turret. You can ground mount them in like fighting holes, but they generally were in cap platoons, combined arms teams, and on LAVs in the Marine Corps. So the interesting piece was like learning the system in school and then getting to the fleet and having a whole nother. I had a whole nother weapon system essentially because it's attached to the vehicle itself. So, yeah.
I'm sure there's a learning curve. Like with any job, right? It's like most of what you get in the fleet is all OJT, right? It's all on the job. And, you know, you're learning from guys who are way senior and who have used these weapon systems. So I'm sure it's like what you learn in secondary school is, you know, doesn't quite live up to like using it in the field itself, using it in a real world situation. So
the hardest part to like any of the boot camp or any of the school stuff was my body was severely damaged from football. Like it was like messed up. And I said I was good, of course, you know.
Exactly. Oh, for sure. Your recruiter's like, just say no to everything. I tore my ACL in high school football my senior year, and very similar, where I was like, my recruiter was like, just say no, bro, just say no to everything. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's fine, we'll heal up on it. And sure enough, freaking reared back and bit me in the ass a few times.
Yeah, it so that was the toughest part of it. It's like because that weapon system itself is just so massive and the rounds are so massive. But yeah, that school was only about, I think it's about 6 weeks. So, and then, yeah, like I said, I eventually got a secondary MOS, which became my primary. I was 0311, which I got through OJT in Iraq, essentially.
So, when it comes to, you know, being both like two different MOSs, does that mean that you're kind of like you might be assigned to different missions, or how does it work to have kind of both of those things? Like, does one take kind of your primary, and then the other one is just kind of like a backup that if you need be, or is it kind of you're splitting your job across the board?
Well, you know, honestly, you know, like my first deployment, my second deployment were very different. In my first deployment, I deployed as an 0352 tow missileman, right? We just did the tow, like mm-hmm. we didn't touch javelin or anything else. That's a demolition man's job. Mm-hmm. But I had those skills, but most of the time on both deployments, I was an 0311 and I would get pulled in for special like a couple times because my vehicle caught on fire on the way up to Fallujah in 04. It just like had a malfunction and caught on fire. So we couldn't use our vehicle. So I got put down on as a dismount, as a scout for like a mortar team or like this vehicle or that vehicle. And then every now and then they'd be like, all right, man, so you have to go low tows today, get in that vehicle. And, you know, so it's, yeah, we're all pretty adaptable. You know, most Marines I was around could have done it, did each other's jobs, you know, but, on my second deployment, I had nothing to do with tows. I was just an 0311 section.
So when it comes to 0311, from my previous experience in talking to people, the conversation of both patrols on foot and patrols in vehicle come up. And since you kind of already had experience when it comes to LAVs, light armor, I think that's what you use, the term you use.
Yeah.
There's probably, I don't know. Did you feel more comfortable in either of the situations? Did you feel,
I felt way more comfortable on the ground on my feet.
Really?
Our unit, like my first deployment, we were just a company of us and we took our vehicles got messed up, man. Like people got really hurt and people died really bad. And most of the time it was because we were on the vehicle. Whereas on the ground, I mean, being in the city sucked, you know, like, but being in the city in the back of a vehicle loading missiles is terrible. Like it's, or like outside of a city, like you have no control, you have no windows and you're loading these freaking 80-pound missiles and you're telling the dude, the gunner to go fire. You know, and then you're handling misfires and like, whereas like when I was in 0311 on the ground, I felt like it's had a little bit more control and we spent a lot of time off the vehicles as scouts. But man, being in those vehicles, man, they were our safety nets because we had so much firepower around us. But I mean, if anyone deployed to Iraq in 2004 around that area and knows about LEVs getting flipped over like they're nothing. So. You know, I had to drive at times. My first deployment, a lot of guys got hurt, killed, and we lost a lot of vehicles. And I was in three different platoons my first deployment. And at one time, I drove the vehicles. You know, I was a driver. Had the other guy got sick, and they needed someone to drive this freaking vehicle. Now I went from 0352 to 0311 to 0313. And I'm driving around, and, you know, we lost a couple drivers. So, yeah, it's interesting, man. Like, but yeah, I was a kid. I was 18 years old. So like 19, right. 20, whatever we got to do, I'm going to do it.
Right. You got that adrenaline pushing you forward.
Yeah. And because it's your job, right. And because with Marines, especially, you know, most people in the military will say, you know, you got to be a, you know, fireman first and a rifleman first. And, but like you said, the just that thought of like you're not in control, and when you're in a vehicle like that has a weapon system like that, you're a hard target, right? You're a freaking you know, a target that you know they're pinging on. So, you know, I can imagine that just be it feeling like a sardine kind of packed in there, not really having control over if you're gonna run over a freaking IED or Now I got to ask you too, as an anti-tank sort of MOS, did you guys run into? I mean, did the Iraqis have initially outside of Fallujah? Did they have a bunch of armored vehicles?
Nah, man.
Yeah.
No, all they had was graveyards of armored vehicles. Like, no, Not at all. So like,
so most of what you're hitting is IEDs and improvised explosives, right?
Yeah. I mean, we got, you know, there's ambushes and whatnot, rockets, machine guns, you know, RPGs, all that stuff. Like, you know,
yeah.
You know, enemy moving on your position or ambushing you along the side of the road or whatever. But like our biggest threat was, you know, was a bomb or a suicide bomber or a vehicle bomb. That's what you're afraid of.
Yeah.
So, yeah, not, you know, that wears on you. You know, a lot of people have gone out there and told their war stories, and you know, there's a lot of good work that our SF community now is doing these days, and their community's been pushed to the brink operationally around the world, and you know, and we hear a lot of those stories, and we talk to the kid that like was locked inside of a driving capsule on an Abrams tank for a whole siege of the city for a month. Like, the kids, Jesus. Guys, crazy, man. You know, like drivers would lose their mind from being down in the hole for 20 hours, 30 hours, 40 hours, 50 hours.
Right.
You know, so it takes a toll.
And that's a perspective. And with the heat, especially, I was just going to say, like, the heat of that, right? Nothing can really prepare you for that. Even, you know, Paris Island or Camp Lejeune in the middle of summer, like nothing can really prepare you for like for that. And that's a perspective we haven't got yet, you know, and that's what's really fascinating is that being in an armored vehicle, that sort of experience. That's a trip, man. You're pulling how many hours would you be in a vehicle, like on a patrol or pushing into the city?
It depends, man. I mean, some operations are only like 4 days. Sometimes you had, you know, you're going out. We did a lot. We provided a lot of security and like outer cordon, like support for some of the groups, some like, you know, force companies that were operating in our area. So like sometimes we would leave in the middle of the night and go hit a house and then drive back and be done for a couple of days. But I mean, there's times when we were out for, where you're supposed to be gone for 2 days and we were gone for 3 weeks, you know, but countless hours in those vehicles. I was lucky enough to get out of the vehicle a lot, as a rifleman, but man, yeah, it was really hot. So the heat, cause the vehicles weren't, they only have heat. They don't have air. They didn't have air control back then. So if it's 120 degrees out, it's 150 degrees in the hole where the driver is, and he's losing his mind.
So you briefly mentioned that there was I think you said misfires when you were talking about loading the rockets. Did you ever feel like endangered for your life just off of like faulty equipment or defective equipment or something like that? Were you ever like, not necessarily worried about the, you know, the opposition, but what you're handling?
100%. Yeah. I mean, there's levels of fear and being nervous and scared, and there's other ways and avenues approach to that fear. And when you're sitting next to six missiles, and they had like this back then, I don't know if it's still, because, you know, like I said, my war is a long time ago now. But they had these little sight glasses on the actual weapon itself, and three colors, and black's bad, black's always bad, right? And like you're sitting in armored vehicles next to six of these, two loaded, and they're all the indicators are black. It's like these things can misfire at any time. And you just hope you don't get hit by an IED in one of those, because you're done. You're gonna get evacuated. So yeah, like, there's been times in the middle of a gunfight I was like running around with a fucking 80-pound missile that was misfired. I had to get it out of the vehicle, you know, like.
Jeez.
And then the next day I wake up and I'm in another platoon, you know, because we're going over here now and they need me for this. Yeah, so. But you know, man, like when you're around your brothers and stuff and they depend on you. You know, like, come on, come on, come on, like telling you that we got to go, we got to move, we got to do this, like your life and your safety, like you got to like check that shit and just operate. And you know, the little training I had, I gave it the care and the love for your brothers around you is more important than your training, I think. And I didn't have a ton of training, you know, so like, I'm going to run a mile with this fucking missile on my arm if I have to for these guys, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So good thing I didn't have to do that. Yeah. But
right. So you also, in March of 2004, you took over for the 2nd Air Force in Bahariya.
We took over for the 82nd Airborne.
Okay.
Wow.
So I know it has a nickname, or it's been called Dreamland. Could you touch on that? Why, or was it a Dreamland? Like, why was it called Dreamland?
Yeah, you know, man. I think, yeah, I know 100% about it. I know all about it. It was it was a beautiful space. But it was Uday Hussein's, one of his like water retreats. Like, he had a water park outside of Fallujah, I guess. And we ourselves and a small like Air Force unit, another infantry battalion or company was in there. Because it was like this little, there's all these cottages around this man-made lake pond with bridges and beautiful trees. And it was gorgeous. It was all terraced and like
little paddle boats and shit. I'm watching the video right now. It's crazy.
Oh, you actually can see the old advertisement for it.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's real. It's a crazy place, man. I remember driving in there and it was like,
what is this?
What the? There's a huge like apple orchard on it or something.
Wow.
But yeah, we cohabitated that space for, I don't know, till the end of September, beginning of October that year, and we had to build out our part of the camp. We didn't have anywhere to sleep, hard structure when we showed up. But yeah, when we're done, we had a med station, we had a chapel, tents, we had areas for our vehicles. But it was really close to the city, man, and it wasn't very much not like Dreamland. Because when shit went off, you know, we were so close, and you know, a lot of rockets, and I mean, you could see our tent from the road. So like, yeah, but man, I mean, in that space, in that time, like it was our little area where we found refuge, as close to refuge as we could.
I gotta ask you too, Andy, like a big part of like, you know, when you're on deployment and you know you're in the grind, you gotta find those moments of solitude. And what were some of the things that like brought solitude to you? Like, you know, card games, or like, you know, what was it you got to do with your fellow Marines that like always stuck with you, is like, you know, I can kind of check out for a second and you know, just like shoot the shit and be one.
We hated it. I hated it then, and we all hated it, but sandbag working parties, man. Like, I miss them.
Yeah.
You know, cause, you know, I think about those times, and it sucked, dude. Like, not only have to go out and operate, but we have to fill these sandbags and build our camp and like, you know, so like when we're not working or out there, you know, you got to come back and like build this place. But like, yeah. You know, I'm your young kid. Like, I looked up to all these Marines that were older than me. And like, you know, I had memories of guys laughing and cracking jokes, filling sandbags that are no longer here. You know, they died, you know, 15, yeah. 16 years ago. You know, playing cards, it's man. I smoked a shit ton of Newports.
100?
Oh man.
Oh yeah. You get 100, you get a car in 100 pack, hundreds box.
Yeah. The box fingers.
Yeah, dude. The problem with the 100 boxes, it was too big for the pockets. So like,
yeah.
Those were like, you know, those were like a treat. You know, yeah, but
Newbies.
Yeah,
oh god.
Yeah, we yeah, it's like, you know, playing cards, you learn a lot about life, you learn a lot about the Marine Corps. Like we play a lot of spades, a lot of dominoes. Mm-hmm. And like guys that have been in 10, 15, 20 years were really good at those games. And like,
for sure,
you just get destroyed. And if you lost, like everyone wanted to hurt you. But you're not supposed to lose. You're supposed to be the best. You know, but it was just like, it was fun, man. That's when all the like the jokes and the humor would come out.
What was your favorite MRE? Just out of curiosity. I know some people
It was an old one. And I only had it a few times. But it was from probably the 90s, like before they switched to like the generation MREs I had, but it was a chicken and rice. That was my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Did it like,
yeah,
it
didn't Dominica's, Dominica's.
Or the chili mac.
The chili mac, always. Yeah, dude. You can't beat the chili mac. I try to recreate it every now and again.
I will never eat that shit ever in my whole life, man.
They don't have those readily available in Guatemala, I'm sure.
No. Anything like you can't even eat a sloppy Joe, man. Can't even eat a sloppy.
Okay, this is back to Fallujah, because you're right outside of Fallujah, right, like for the first Battle of Fallujah. And, you know, this has been talked about. I actually had to do a little bit of research for this way back in the day because my Matt was casting me for a role of a character who is supposed to be preparing for the first Battle of Fallujah. And it, you know, it's been talked about or compared to things like Quay City from other wars. Were you a participant in the first Battle of Fallujah, since you were, I mean, you're right next to it and like right around the time it happened? And if you were, what was it like?
I was actually thinking about this other day because I figured you guys would ask, but can't really tell you like exactly where I was located during like the first, because they hung those contractors on like April 1st from the bridge.
Okay.
They killed those four U.S. contractors or whoever they were, just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So the first like 10 days, I want to say like we were kind of the outskirts of Fallujah. And like kind of nailing down routes for people to come in and out and like doing stuff at night, moving around. And dude, it was intense. I mean, we went from not getting shot at to getting ambushed multiple times in 24 hours. We went from just hanging out, like no contact for almost all of March. And then like the whole, if you were driving through that city, you were probably going to get shot at by someone. I was blessed to not, personally take any, like we didn't take any really bad injuries in those first couple weeks. I saw a lot of other Marines get fucked up from other units. But yeah, man, it was like that's when I popped my cherry. I hate to say that. It's probably not a good thing to say anymore. But yeah, man, I got shot at by a sniper for the first time, you know, mortar fire, like, you know, accurate mortar fire for the first time, RPGs, like wow. All the whole, I went from nothing to 100, you know,
real fast.
But I will say this, you know, my war experience is different than the guy that was on another street or across the palm field somewhere else. You know, it's different. My war experience was different than the dude standing right next to me. But yeah, it's when I started smoking cigarettes. It was wild, man. It was the whole city. The whole area from all the way out west, all the way up into Husseiba and through Ramadi and Hit and all those cities, like they were all the whole Marine Corps was fighting. And
do you remember like what it was like when you received the first news or that kind of like that? Do you remember the shit, like the turning point for you, like when everything? Because it obviously sounds like night and day. But was it kind of like, you know, like the 9/11 story? Was it, there's a specific moment where you remember like hearing about it for the first time or something shift?
You know, I was so young that first week, 10, 20 days in April. Like I turned 19 on my birthday. course, I turned 19 on my birthday, but it was on my birthday. We were going to go raid the cement factory. And I got super sick. It was after like 20 days of just us continually going and going and going. I think the turning point, man, was when we got hit by a V-bid about on April 30th.
So was it was that like, a V-bid? Was that?
Yeah, it's a car drove up and blew up in the middle of our patrol and killed a couple Marines, wounded a couple others. And I think that's when things changed, man. Like even after all the intense moments of the first part of the month, that was when it really, that was the first time we lost some of our own Marines. It was catastrophic, you know, like just the complexity of that, someone driving up and blowing themselves up when, you know, we were having.
So, no. And so Andy, like, you know, you're feeling the fragility of that on a day-to-day basis. And were you, was that ever lost on you? Did you have like, did you garner strength from like your senior Marines? You know, you got out as a sergeant, and I think there's a lot to be said for that. You know, you had leadership qualities, obviously. But did you, what did you gain from them as far as dealing with the loss, you know, dealing with losing guys that you were just playing spades with?
Yeah, like, yeah, you know, so I had an interesting commanding officer. On my first appointment, I won't mention his name. Not important. But I had a really good, you know, our gunnery sergeant was rock solid. Our first sergeant was a savage that loved his Marines with everything he had. He could just, I feel like first sergeant could fuck up the whole world. These guys are like these big, badass dudes. And we had some platoon commanders that were really good and young, but they were like, they were good leaders. And I had some NCOs that, or I got one guy in particular, you know, like this guy Keith that was around me on my first appointment. And I looked at him a lot for strength as like a big brother. Like if Keith's here, I'm good, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I always had a leadership in the sense of like, if people, there was some work to be done, I was gonna raise my hand first. Like if there's an opportunity to do more missions, I was going to raise my hand. And I thought the best way I could do to like be the best around my guys is always be willing to go. And so I wouldn't let down any of these great leaders I had that cared about their Marines. And so, yeah. So I knew at a young age, when I was like 19, and I talked to this one guy, Ronnie, he was one of the platoon commanders and he was in charge of that patrol that day. And I think about it now, but I knew then, like, this kid's only 24 years old, maybe, you know, and like, he's got to call KAA over to his Marines over the radio, you know, following orders. Yeah. And so I always just looked to them to, you know, I was scared the whole time, dude. A lot of people think I'm just like, I'm not fearful. I don't get scared easy, but no, I was afraid the whole time and I didn't want to die. And, I just looked at the good examples of leadership and I called out the ones that were shitty. Especially as I gained some, you know, as I increased in rank and experience and deployment time, like I knew what was just and not just. And I learned it from some of the NCOs, the senior enlisted and a couple of our platoon commanders on my first deployment. And without those guys, maybe I wouldn't be here, you know?
Yeah. It's funny you say calling out the bad, the sort of the ones that are lack in certain areas, you know, and I think that's really crucial and in the military as a whole, because you have this structure that you're not really supposed to, you know, call that out. But when it's life and death, literally, when it's, you know, your choices are impacting whether everybody comes back or, you know, five come back. And that's just especially from the Navy side, there were so many things that were wrong and so many things that we'd like to call out. And, you know, on the enlisted side, and the enlisted guys were always the ones that had, like you said, you know, 24 years old and they've got rank, and you've got millions of dollars worth of equipment, but pilot people's lives in your hands, literally. And if you don't do your job correctly, people don't come back. And that's just the dichotomy of that, and just the snapshot of that coming back and transitioning. And I want to ask you this too, before we kind of get, move on. But after your second deployment, did you know, like, before your second deployment that you were, like, you were going to get out, you were going to separate? And, like, what was it that kind of motivated you to, like, you were like, yeah, I have to get out. I got to live my life.
No, man, like, I was getting ready for a third deployment. And I chose to stay in the company with a few other guys that I did the first two tours with. And it was at that point that I didn't want to come home. I didn't really want to go back to Connecticut. And I really loved the brotherhood of it all. So I was thinking about possibly re-enlisting. But the catalyst for me to getting out was kind of complex, right? It was a mixture of some of my injuries, and then my father was dying. So I got, like, right before I was supposed to leave on my third deployment, you know, 3 years, 4 years, my dad essentially dropped dead, and they brought him back. And so that was the Marine Corps kind of, I said goodbye to my, you know, my company when they set up my squad that I had trained with for, you know, months. And I came home and was looking after my dad in the hospital with my aunt. And then I eventually got out because I couldn't really deploy anymore. So,
right.
Yeah, there were some ideas I wanted to re-enlist and stuff, but you know, I just didn't.
Family came first, you know. Family came first in a situation like that. That's,
I had to, man. And it was really amazing. I struggled with for a long. It was the worst day, one of my worst days of my life, watching my brothers go off overseas without me. But maybe just some higher purpose didn't need me over there, and maybe I decided to get out, you know, and kind of move on with my life, or try at least.
Yeah. Which is always easier said than done, you know, that whole transition period. But especially under your circumstances, that's pretty unique. And it's incredible.
Yeah, if I didn't, you know, I had some really good friends back home, and their families opened up their doors for me, you know, because I didn't really have, my dad had some issues with the law and his wife, and my mom was kind of, I don't know, going through her stuff, and I didn't really have anywhere to go. So my transition started as my, right before the military started, me looking after myself and taking care of myself, because my family was kind of effed up. So yeah, I didn't really have an option to mope around, you know, but it wasn't the best circumstances, man. It was actually pretty terrible, especially up until my dad. And then it was just like 2 years had gone by, and I'm out of the Marine Corps, and I'm like, whoa, what happened? You know, it just happens so fast. So I never got to, like, a send-off from my unit. I never got to say goodbye to all these dudes that I never saw them again, man, except for a few of them. Mm-hmm. Like, a couple of the dudes, we went to one guy's wedding. We met up once or twice, and but most of the guys I'll never, you know. We went to a funeral a couple of years ago, but the guys I did two deployments with at first, most of them I haven't talked to them since 2006, that day when they left.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you never know. Maybe one of them will show up at your surf camp. You'll be able to.
Yeah, maybe. It was kind of crazy.
One of those, bro.
Yeah.
You know, that's the dream, isn't it? You know, being able to, because, I mean, you're doing like what you're doing, like with your surf camp in a similar way of like helping out, you know, veterans and people that are in need. And so like, if you were able to end up helping the people that touched your life, I mean, isn't that kind of like the ultimate goal, you know, to give back to those people that you couldn't necessarily in the first place give back to, but now you can? Like, I know it's kind of a, you know, a weird way of looking at it, but it's like, that's like, for me at least, the reason I started this is because I wanted to be able to, you know, show up for Matt, like show up for Matt Domenico, because this is, you know, like he was my really only connection to the veteran community besides like my dad. But then even then he was back in Vietnam. And so it's like, you know, being able to help out the people that you are close to is really important in general, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just rambling here about, or being a little sentimental here, but I feel like that would be my, if I was in your shoes, I guess, and I don't want to speak for you, but like, I would just feel so, you know, I'd feel honored if I was able to help someone out that like was there for me back then. But maybe that's, you know, my unique take on it. But getting into a little bit, and I know we're going a little bit forward here, but I'm curious about how like kind of you started to mix both surfing and like everything and kind of your love or your dedication to the community. So what was it like for you coming out of your second deployment to come back into being a civilian, knowing that, you know, it's going to be a hard transition, it's going to be I don't even know if you knew what the transition was going to be like, but kind of knowing from where you came from, like coming across the seas and coming back to this life that you're experiencing here. Do you remember kind of any thoughts that went through your head about that or anything like that?
Yeah. I mean, I remember just sitting on the beach. It was my 22. It was the summer of 2007. And I sit on the beach with all my friends, and like 4 years had passed, you know? And my friends have been going to college, and I would see them every now and then. I'd go up to UConn and to drink with them and stuff and have some fun. And I'm sitting on the beach with all these kids and all these guys around me, and they're all the, you know, kids two, three years younger than me, people 5 years older than me. We're all just like hanging out. And it was just so like weird. It was just like what just happened? Because everything around me right now is nothing's changed. You know, like all these kids are doing their own thing. They got jet skis and dirt bikes, they're going to college or starting businesses. And it was just like a really surreal moment of I made it. I really don't know what to make out of it, but I'm okay. You know, I'm alive and I'm just gonna try to live here. And that's that, you know. But it wasn't until like 2009 or so, 2008, 2000, I started having some issues, you know. But my whole world changed, and no one around me really, outside of a couple guys I joined with that served in different branches or kind of knew what was going down over there. And you know, I hated being called a hero or like people thanking me for it. You know, coming out of my second deployment was different than my first, but a couple of things happened and I didn't really feel super proud of myself. And I was like, I don't know if you people would be calling me a hero if you knew what I had to do. And it wasn't anything extremely that bad, but I value every human life 100%. And yeah, I just, it's pretty wild, man. I mean, I got into a lot of confrontations, a lot of fights and stuff. And I was just looking to get hurt, essentially, man. I didn't know it then, but I was just finding ways to get hurt. And like, it's interesting, man.
What do you think that was? What do you think? Because that's a sentiment I hear from a lot of Marines, especially grunts, right? Is they would get angry. They get sort of mad when people would call them a hero because of what they're carrying, the burden they're carrying back with them, and that outlet, that outlet in which to release. What, like, how was that thought process going through you? Was it like you were looking for confrontation to feel some sort of like to feel alive again, or like, correct me if I'm wrong or I'm off base here, but what do you think that desire was like looking back on it?
It's scary, man. I think about those times and like, I think I just wanted to get hurt, man. Like I don't know. It screws up your moral compass, you know? If you go to war to do things, I don't know, make your world a better place, so you don't mm-hmm. at all, actually. And you feel like, I felt like I had to, like, in a weird, subconsciously, I had to pay for evil, right, that I was a part of. Mm-hmm. And things I had to do. And, you know, I'm glad I went through a period of almost remorse and guilt over it. Because if I didn't, then like how mentally and how physically am I messed up for it not to really affect me. And we all have to go through a journey with it. And for me, it's been years. But I honestly, I was just very reckless. So I just wanted to get hurt. And I don't know, some days I just wanted to die, man. But
yeah. That's a common, you know, that's a common thread, but we always know that there's a light at the top. We do from, you know, our experiences now, and especially where you're at now, there's a light. There was a light there at the end of the tunnel. And there was someone to kind of pull you through that. Did you find that when you went to college? So you went to college, did you get integrated into the, did you get plugged into the VA first, or did you like, get it? Was there like a veterans program at the college that you were a part of? I know, because that's where actually Domenico and I met. And I know that was a huge part of my transition and just getting back to some sense of normalcy. But what was that for you that kind of was the wake up call? Like, I need to address this.
You know, honestly, man, it hit me in 2011. I was living with a couple of veterans. One of them I had grown up with, and he served a couple of tours in Afghanistan. And we were captains of the football team together. And he was really supportive of me and my life. And was having some tough times. And so I started to like trying to figure out maybe what it was. And I, you know, I would go to the VA, and I remember one day the occupational therapist started crying when I was telling my story. And I was like, fuck, dude, like, I can't talk to anyone about this. Like, it's just ladies crying in front of me, this professional. She had a huge heart, man, and she was just hurting for me. You know, and I was like, oh, this isn't the place for me. You know, so it wasn't until 2014, because I was in a relationship. I had been in a relationship for a little bit, and I cared very much for this woman, and I was struggling. In 2014, I had to go to the hospital. And I went to the hospital. I just told my lady, I just got to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
And she's like, why? I said, I just got to go. You got to bring me there now. And she brought me there. And I didn't even know what to tell the doctors. But I'm like, I'm fucked up, man. And I don't know what's going on. I'm like, I'm really scared right now. I'm passing out. Blah, 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 blah. And he just like put his hand on my shoulder. He's like, man, like, we don't do everything good here. I know that the public likes to say that, but we do some things really good. And we can take care of you, man. And that's when I started like officially receiving treatment for the trauma piece. And then that led to some other doctor appointments and other, but it wasn't until 2014 that I really started to look at myself in the mirror and like, I need to work on this. And it's still a process, you know, it's been a long journey, it's been a lonely journey, but it was 2014. And that's right around the time I started working with like veterans at first. So it's kind of interesting how it all kind of shaped up.
And fellow combat veterans, were they fellow combat veterans or just veterans from all sorts of walks of life?
Well, this one guy in particular, he was with one of the groups. He was in the Army, he was Special Forces, but he'd just gotten back from a rotation. And I met him and his lady on the beach. I was teaching surf lessons anyways. And I just saw his tattoos. He saw my one of my tattoos, and we were just jiving. And so I didn't really like care to be around other veterans up until I went to the hospital. I had a couple other friends, Marine friends in Charleston that I rolled with. But I met this guy and, okay, man, like surfing's helped me out a lot. I know you just got back, man. A personal challenge to you for a free surf lesson. It's like, I'll come out there with you, man. And I gave him a surf lesson. We talked, and then another person, and then kind of one thing led to another, you know? But I saw like, I couldn't, you know, going in my own treatment, my own path. I mean, we're still working on this, and I'm still like, I just started a new type of treatment a couple months ago. That's been really, really, really helpful. Like, I've never felt this way in my adult life, this good. But I saw like, okay, like these doctors at the VA are good. Like they got their specialties, but this is for like acute stuff. Like we need to bring some of this therapy out on the beach, out in the community. The community needs to be part of this somehow, some way. Like how do we do it? I was like, surf lessons, free surf lessons. But those are just surf lessons. Like what about maybe you getting a doctor or a mental health or like a social worker part of the team? We can do therapy on the beach. And we'll do that first. We tried that and it worked. And that's kind of how it grew.
From there to yoga and the wellness, the mental wellness and that type of stuff, right?
The wellness stuff's pretty cool. It's there's a lot of it's based on this process that a doctor in Charleston created, and has a lot of support from like applied evolutionary psychology, essentially. Like we just grew up in packs of people, and like how we live and operate is very important to how we view ourselves among others and with others. And, you know, so we started with like trauma therapy at first, acute trauma therapy. And then we said we needed more of like a overall approach, because we can't just single up a veteran that has been shot at one time or never at all. Doesn't mean they don't have issues. They don't have trouble from transitioning from the military service. You know, there are acute cases. You know, I was one of those myself and some of my friends, but like, it's not for everyone. Like what can any veteran, no matter what their background, go through and still get something out of it mentally. So we created a wellness program, more like psychoeducation. And then yoga, we added 2.5 years ago, and it's really enhanced our user experience, you know, people that come through the foundation, and all support surfing, you know? So.
I'm curious, because this really lines up with another interview that we did in the past. Did you ever listen to our Doc Jet Garner interview?
No, I need to.
He was a corpsman. I really recommend checking out that interview, because he talks about outdoor therapy like an outdoor therapy kind of thing that he does, where he does like river rafting and like other sorts of kind of like, you know, outdoor, just to like with veterans, like trying to get them to experience nature. And that really kind of falls in line with what you're talking about with surfing. And so what I was hoping that you could talk about, you know, why surfing, why the outdoors, what is it about, you know, being in the ocean, that really, that like fuels you, and like, why does it kind of tie in? 'Cause you know, we've had surfers, it's so amazing how there are certain themes that kind of move across. Our first interview, he's a surfer. We've had another, I think one of the reservists was a surfer as well in Texas. And you know, we've also had, the interview I was just talking about the Doc, Gardner interview. He's an outdoor therapy. So all of these kind of things just tie together in a way. So I was hoping that you could touch a little bit about why surfing, why the ocean, what specifically about that fuels you, and why did you want to give it back to the community?
Man, like I told you guys a few days ago, like the first time I ever went surfing, like as an adult on my own with someone, I'm going to go out and try this like 100%. I slept that night better than I had slept in years. I was like, man, I want to do that again. But there's something about being in the ocean, it's being in water, it's moving, it's like not constant, it's forever changing. But just the amount of focus, like you have to be so present when you surf. I mean, if it's a small day, you can go out and have fun with your friends and screw off. And but like where I'm at now, you got to focus. You got to think about like, okay, this wave's coming at me right now. What do I have to do to put myself on this thing so I can ride it, right? And the amount of like focus it takes and mindfulness it takes, and I hate this word mindful, it's kind of gotten overused, but like when I surf, it's like the most mindful thing I can do. Because I need to see, I need to breathe, I need to hear, I need to be fully aware of what's going on around me. And then like you duck dive through the water, man. Just duck diving through like clear water, salty. You just feel like you just, whatever just happened before that in your life is gone. It's like, I don't know, I just, every time I duck dive or something, I feel refreshed. But for me personally, man, surfing like really opened up my heart to the world again. It kind of opened me up to be around other groups of people and to kind of like break me out of my shell that I kind of was in when I got out. But honestly, man, it's, you know, people talk a lot about loving yourself and this whole mindfulness, like, get yourself better movement around the world. Like talk about loving yourself. And I don't think I really understood what that was until about a year and a half ago when I really didn't love myself all that much. But I knew when I surfed and my life around surfing, there was a lot of love shown. Going to sleep early, waking up early, like recycling, like not throwing my trash. Like all these little things in my life started to get better when I started surfing because I was just like showing myself a little bit of love and that was just my expression of it. And I sleep better, my appetite's better, my anxiety's less, my depression's less. All if I surf at least a few times a week. If I can surf every day, I'm glowing. Glowing and flowing, baby, all the time. So that's what surfing is to me. And that's what like putting my, like holding this like surfboard and like paddling out and waxing it up. And like when my feet hit that board, hopefully they land in the right spot. Sometimes you're not. And you go and you just focus in that moment and you hit the beach. You weren't thinking about what the hell you were thinking about before you walked out in that ocean, swam and paddled. So, yeah.
And the beautiful irony in all of that is the fact that like you have to be mindful and in the moment as you're preparing yourself to, you know, propel yourself on this wave as wave takes you. To be mindful in that moment, but to also block out, it literally makes you block out everything else, like you said, that's going on around you or your thoughts beforehand. And I thought what was really cool from the website too, on warriorsurf.org. And for our listeners, you know, please go check it out. It's freaking amazing what you're doing and what you're doing for other veterans. But one of the really cool things on the homepage I thought was under the benefits of surf therapy. And specifically, you know, you have the enhanced interpersonal communication, but the reduced isolation, you know, how ironic is that? Like you're in the middle of the ocean, you know, by yourself sometimes, but with other guys. But when you're catching that wave, you're isolated to that moment. You're isolated to that wave. But at the same time, you're with other people experiencing that same thing. And I find it really almost poetic.
I went through overseas so I could do it. And I think, you know, one of my really good friends, Jesse Miller, and shit, even one of the co-founders, Tyler Crowder, both docs, you know, like their hands were literally, you know, like running a nonprofit, man, and starting one and building one to get it to where it's at now. It's a lot of work and it's, you know, I've done a lot of work and there's tons of people that have helped it get to where it's at now. Now it's not going to go anywhere. it's going to be pretty sustainable soon. It made me really like look at myself and like my happiness and what I want to do and like my life. And I'm getting to a point now where, you know, I will continue to help out this mission, because I didn't start a charity, man. Me and Tyler didn't start a charity. We started a mission with clear objectives, you know, and the objectives were very raw and premature at first, but they're really important. We didn't want people putting bolts in their heads anymore, you know?
Yep.
And like, so we did that. And now it's, you know, I had some issues about a year and a half ago. I was going through a really tough time, and I realized that like I had all these other tools, but I needed to check in personally in some other ways. And through that journey in the past year and a half, you know, I see my future going in a different direction and running a nonprofit full time. Because I want to stay true to myself and my own growth, and what this program pushes others to do is to challenge yourself and grow, and like, don't accept your environment or your circumstances. You know, don't pray for an easy life. Pray for a stronger, a more of an ability to accomplish what you want to accomplish. And, you know, so hindsight 50-50, like I started this and it's pushing me in my next part of my life to really listen to my heart and my mind and my soul and like where I want to go and what I want to do and the life I want to live. And without my work experience, without surfing, without this foundation, I wouldn't be where I'm at today. You know, so it's great. Like I'm honored to share this experience and like see some people really make some big transitions in their lives the past 6 years. But it's time to observe myself, do the same, I guess is what I'm getting at. And, so like I emphasize on our surfing and our yoga and our wellness, like mental health is a big piece. And you better have a good toolkit, but also too, it's okay to be who you are. And like, we try really hard to meet veterans where they're at when they show up to our programs, whether it's a 1 week retreat or the 3 month program on Folly. And, you know, it's okay to be, we're perfectly normal for the things we experience, you know, and, as young men and women in this world. And, like, it doesn't have to dictate the rest of your life, but it can have some really big defining factors, given that you use that experience for the positive. And it's okay to be okay, and it's okay not to be 100% all the time. Like, I think people are getting destroyed by this perfect vision of self that's driven by, like, social media. And, like, it's really, like, people are captivated by this optimal performance, and that's good and all, but it's okay to be who you are, you know, and through your experiences. And I'm starting to see that now as a grown man that has started this and walked through this foundation the past 6 years. Like it's time for myself to do the same, you know, because Warrior Surf is a big part of my life, and it will forever will be. But I got a couple of years left and a lot to do, you know. So, yeah.
And before, it's funny too, because it's like before you can help others fully, you got to know that to help yourself, you got to know to like take that. And like you said, it's okay to not be okay, but it's also okay for veterans. It's okay for this community and what this podcast represents it to ask for help, to talk about it, to reach out, to reconnect with those people that you may have lost touch with. And, you know, we need that, especially. You know, it goes for females as well. It goes for the female counterparts, and how important that is, that, you know, they don't feel isolated. They're a demographic represented in the military that that's underrepresented and needs to have their voice as well. And I think what your foundation does so well is, like you said, it meets them where they're at, regardless of age, regardless of physical, sort of limitations. And it's just, yeah, it's you're doing God's work, man. So you should be proud of yourself, and keep doing the work, brother.
You know, like, it's, you know, you bring up the lady, the our female veterans. you know, I didn't, you know, you go and you serve the country and you fight in the time of war and you're a Marine and you're in the infantry. And like, you know, I was a, you know, a freshman JV level warfighter. Like I wasn't in the big leagues. I didn't take the long walk. I did my job and I handled it every day in front of me the best I could until I didn't have to anymore. But I didn't serve this country and I didn't serve it as a woman. And been kind of taken back by some of the stories I've heard over the years. I can't, you know, I'm not going to bring them up, but you know, my foundation is led by women. Essentially, like we have our board of directors, bunch of dudes. It's not like we're supposed to have women on our board. It's just when that happens, that day comes, the day comes. But like our yoga director, female, wellness director, female, the lady that is essentially going to take over my role, female, married to a combat veteran, 4 kids, and was raised by a veteran. Some of our biggest troops are volunteer coordinator led by women. Like
that's awesome.
Women are such like, I never, like I said earlier, like I didn't really understand their experience because honestly, man, and nor is it my fault. I served with dudes and only dudes. I very rarely came across women. And if we came across, it was usually in camp or like somewhere way out far and it wasn't long. You know, so I never observed anything that happened with women. You know, like I know they can do like, but at the same time, man, like there's a lot of women in our military. And from what I've heard from our female veterans, that their experience was pretty shitty. And like they couldn't even, so at times didn't feel safe, all fear supported overseas or back in garrison, you know, and like that's bullshit. And I know it's probably changed a bunch through the years since I've been out, but it's still a problem because I'm dealing with the transition piece and my staff and the people in our community are dealing with the transition piece. The military is not dealing with that, right? Maybe they're a little bit better than they were before. But I know that our women get treated poorer than we do. And I think it's pretty sad that someone, the amount of the amount of like heart and courage and whatever it takes to like to serve this country and give up 4+ years of your life for your country, is to be respected because it's like a pause, you know. And the women, like Joe Rogan says, women create all the people. Like they're the strongest beings, and through business leadership, I've seen it. Like these women and the good work that they can do. And the people I look for in advice most of the time, women, they didn't get a fair shake in the military, and it's not cool. And I hope that culture changes through the years. I'm not pro like military. I'm not, you never see me with a freaking Marine shirt on. Like I'm not saying I'm not pro military. Everyone needs to get punched. So every now and then someone needs to get punched in the face. I get it. Right. But like
knife-handed. Yeah.
It's just sad, man. It was just disappointing. You know, that these women do everything, like they do all these jobs, if not better. And, you know, I sit at company meetings, man. This is a good example. Like Stephanie, she was in the Navy. Her husband was served during the surge in Iraq. 4 kids. Raised by someone that was in the military, Vietnam era. Like, we'll go to meetings and no one will even really acknowledge that she is even a veteran or even ask her. Right? That she's married to a combat veteran that has struggled. You know, she was raised by one. It's happened to multiple times, you know, or like they talk about it like, oh, I want to take these guys on a trip. Well, hey, asshole, if you look at our stuff, there's a lot of women too, you know, it's not just guys. You're not going to come help us out and just drink beers with a bunch of war vets that are all dudes. There's a lot of women. It's made us push ourselves to like kind of get some more space for women in our community to kind of have some time on their own. Which we've added this past 6 months, like a kind of like a woman's like paddle out, woman's kind of session once a month. It's something. But I mean, basically what I'm getting at, it's just, You just got, it has to change, man.
Yeah, this is where we create that conversation and where that you're taking the steps to acknowledge it, you know? And the fact that you acknowledge that as an integral piece is everything, you know? And we got to talk about it. We got to hear their stories more. It's absolutely the truth, man.
It's sad, man. Like I have these ladies that come and some of them don't want to tell their story because they feel like they don't rate because they didn't go on 3,000-6,000 deployments getting blown up 20 times. As I go through this transition, I thought about leaderships for this next phase of this like beautiful foundation that so many have put their hearts and souls into. Like, sorry, man, I want it to be led by like a strong woman. And I've just seen it. So I don't know what we can do about it. I know we can deal with it in our own way. We can try to make this space for our female veterans. I feel like a really welcoming space. And when you see, we're starting to see a lot more women come out, especially with their families and stuff.
It's rad.
You know, so it's pretty cool, man. There's definitely a different narrative about it. So I just want to be I was raised by a woman and I love women and I just feel like we just need to treat them a little bit better, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I think that like what Brock just said, like really resonates. It's like, it's you taking those steps first that, you know, even start the process. It's like acknowledgement is the first step. Like that's kind of like, you know, with everything that's going on, or has been going on for the past, you know, few months, this whole entire year, a lot of the time it really is like there is no clear first step besides taking acknowledgement and like taking inventory. That's why I think it's really important to say like it's not fair, it's not being spoken about enough, these things need to change, because at the end of the day it's going to be the top brass that's able to make those changes or able to make, you know, like I don't want to quote Gandhi, but be the change you want to see in the world is very key for this kind of point. You know, it's like, you know, getting that out and making the changes within yourself to make it so that everything else can change. Cause that it's going to take everyone and it's going to take everyone for the top brass to see it. And then you've got that whole, you know, it's like taking the domino effect. You hit one domino and then all the other ones fall down. So, I think it's, you know, it's super important that you're already, acknowledging that this is an issue. So if you had any words for anyone that's hesitating to take that first step, that might be struggling a little bit and hasn't necessarily found, like they might be struggling. They might be in the, like they kind of are, you know, they're wallowing in the darkness. What would you say to them? What would you try to do to pull them out of that and say like, hey, this is the direction, like take the first step. This is the direction you need to go. What would you say to them?
Oh man. you know, I would say, man, like if it's someone that's had a similar experience to me in my life, you know, whether it was war or childhood or whatnot, like at some point down the road, like we have to be held accountable to the state of our lives. Right. So like, even though your darkest day was terrible and maybe even one of your best days was still pretty bad, that's how bad your life has been. What can you do now to give yourself enough space to love yourself for just one day, like forget about all the guilt and all the shame that you may have. Love yourself for one day. Like what could you do to take that first step? Like what is that first step for you? Right? For me, I was surfing and a number of other things. But one day I found one of the most important tools I ever found in my life, and it was surfing. But I wouldn't have gotten there without trying it, without taking that step, just to want to feel good again. You know, and that feeling of feeling good is mean, it's a feeling of loving yourself. And when you've lost that, like, that's a dangerous place. But the only one that can take the foot out of the grave and start living a full life is you. you know, and it's, there's nothing poetic. There's nothing beautiful about it. Just love yourself for one day, man. Whatever that day is, whatever that thing is that day, do it. And then maybe the next day you can get up and do it again. Maybe you got to find something else. But it's a beautiful world with a lot of resources out there, especially people in our, born and raised in our country, you know, like some of them even raised in some of the most like just like horrible conditions still have opportunity. But the big piece is take accountability and you loving yourself a little bit more each day, because the world around you will get a hell of a lot better.
Mm. That's awesome, man. I got to ask you too, this is kind of, you know, put a pin in it and bring it full circle, hopefully. But, you know, one of my favorite travel sort of icons and cooks, I got to ask you too, do you still dabble in the culinary arts?
Oh yeah, man. I cook wherever I can go. Awesome. Wherever I go, I try to cook it.
And that's got to be therapeutic in itself, right? That's another like form of therapy. And especially if you're literally feeding yourself, but it almost, you know, feeds your soul at the same time. But I one of my favorite travel icons was Anthony Bourdain, and we lost him, you know, tragically because of mental health, you know. But Anthony Bourdain, he said something along the lines of, you know, the more I travel, the less I know about the world and my place in it, but the more comfortable I am getting lost in all its variances and unknown beauty. And what I love about that is it kind of speaks as to why Guatemala is special to you, you know, and why you find solace there. What is it about traveling to another country that kind of feeds your soul in another way that maybe, you know, wouldn't be quite obvious to somebody else, right? What is it about it that speaks?
I think people underestimate my fear level and my uncomfortability. Like when I feel uncomfortable, like it's a lot. Like I'm not insecure in a sense. I just like, of course I want to have control over my environment, but when I can travel to somewhere else, I don't have all that control anymore. And that's when you grow. It's not escaping, man. For the longest time, I thought maybe I was just escaping down here. I'm just exploring my life, exploring my life. And for me to do that, I need to be vulnerable, man. I need to like not be around 100 people that speak English all the time. I need to be like, it just changes the way it pushes you. You grow and like you become more accepting of people and places and things. And like you realize what you need and you don't need. You know, you don't need 90% of the shit you have in your house. You don't need it. You do not need it. And I don't want to live out of bags the rest of my life. I want a beautiful home and all that good stuff, but it takes to go be vulnerable, man.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, this has been an awesome interview. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today about all this stuff. And, you know, hopefully down the road, we'll be able to maybe have you on again and talk to you about, you know, how your nonprofit's doing and maybe more tales of Guatemala. And who knows, maybe we'll eventually be able to talk over drinks or something. And who knows, you know, like once the world's a little better.
Yeah. Come out to California and help these guys freaking stand up on a wave. I've tried for.
Definitely. One of the pictures I actually sent to you guys was me sitting on the beach in 2019. Working with like a bunch of kids from Los Angeles, teaching them how to surf, all those people. Yeah, I'd love to get back there. I love California.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure and eye opening and moving. And I know for our listeners it's gonna really open some eyes. And that's what this is all about, man. Your nonprofit, our nonprofit, we're doing these things, these collaborations, because the mission is the same. The mission remains the same. And that is to, you know, really stop the 22 a day, you know, make a dent in that and realize that it's okay to be vulnerable and there's a light at the end of the tunnel, man. So it's been awesome, brother. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you so much for being on here.
All right, guys. Thank you
so much. All right. And Thanks for diving into the foxhole.
Thank you to everyone for being in the foxhole with us today. Please follow us on Instagram at Foxhole Stories. And for our listeners out there who are veterans and compelled to tell their story, please visit us at foxholestories.com/contact. Finally, if you are a veteran in crisis or concerned about one, please call the Veteran Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 or send a text to 838-255. This support is free and available 24/7.